This is Luigi Zoja, March 18th, 2005, the father.
The first times, or maybe the only time, I wonder, in which there might be as many men as women. Can I have the hands? Women's hand first, up. And now the man? I'm afraid there's still no hope. I thought Seattle was such a special place that you will finally find fathers, but for a talk on the absent father, you have to have absent fathers, of course. It's a destiny. So it's a psychohistory. A search for an archetypal image from the Jungian point of view, and maybe, in Italian, for instance, I play with the fact that we have just one word for the Greek historia, research. It's a research in both senses. It attempts to be a history and a story, okay, both things. And also, yes, in English you say search and research, and in Italian we have only one word that I play a bit with that, because an archetypal tale connected with the father is the search for the father, which runs throughout our Western history and has no correspondent on the mother's side, because it, for the very simple reason we all know, which is that it's a proverb and a principle of the law, that the mother is certain, and that the mother is physically certain, is there, and therefore the father is not certain or is gone away, etc. So we know, for instance, that the second of the Homeric poems, that is at the very, again, origins of literature of our Western culture, we have the Odyssey, and the Odyssey starts with really with Odysseus coming back, but with his son Telemachus looking for him, you know, the Telemachia. Of course, another maybe premise. We are speaking of the father, but as an archetype, as psychological qualities, as whatever, not necessarily, therefore, speaking of a person in the flesh of masculine gender, okay? Of course, if we want to anticipate that, one of the conclusions is that nowadays, if we want to have the father, we have to have mothers who enact him very, very often. So this psychological quality, this archetype. I was often asked, of course, even now being driven here, what brought me to work on this topic, and of course, the fact of having children and having being a father, which is different. Also, mothers have children, but having specifically paternal problems. Also the typical problems of a divorced father. And also the fact that I felt very much in a country like mine, there is still too much inhibition in speaking about the father. In Latin country, there is a sort of fear of becoming sentimental, sort of a censorship, which is really a big nuisance. Big nuisance also because this is not actually what characterizes the Mediterranean Latin or Greek-Roman culture. Quite the contrary. I will try to quickly touch upon this and, of course, develop it much more in detail tomorrow in the workshop with references to figures of our classical antiquity. Come in, come in. Another, the amount of women keeps increasing. Always hoping for a father. You hear me also over there in the back? So the microphone means it's okay. Okay. One of the basic threads I am going to develop, I have developed in this study of the Father, is that the Father is mostly or basically cultural, a cultural formation. There is, in this sense, a big difference. In our mind, we simplify, you know, particularly, for instance, if we use Jungian categories, but tend to simplify, we go with polarity, say father and mother, yes, but it's very complex. There is a lack of symmetry because there are extremely different realities in history. So I would rather make a reference to polarities within the father. For instance, if I use my language, or at least Latin, I perceive immediately how there is a lack of lack of symmetry. I don't know if I can render that in English. If I say patrimonial, and I say matrimonial, okay, this is Latin, and in English maybe you use it only as an adjective, but of course this comes from the Latin pater and mater, father and mother. But they are two different things, and yet it means that this is it's a legal term, right, of Roman law, which is then, as you know, the beginning of Western tradition of law. That is the right of the mother and the right of the father. And we immediately perceive that even after more than 2,000 years, they represent very different things. The right of the father is the administration of the financial situation of the family. The right of the mother is to have a legal structure for growing the children, a matrimonial situation. So, father is mostly cultural. Mother is a continuation of what we see at all level of evolution, Darwinian evolution from animals to human. That means another tenet, another basic principle which might come out during the discussion, is that basically every paternity, every fatherhood, complete fatherhood, must be also an adoption. The physical fathering is not paternity, is conception in an animal sense, but very different than maternity. Okay. In other terms, men have to choose the fact that they want to be fathers and father of those children, even if the child is my child, is born into the family. And we see it. I mean, the typical discussion even of nowadays has always been throughout our history, and now that we are a bit more conscious and face those things simply a little more directly, but do not have, unfortunately, solutions, we see that fathers must make up their mind and decide to engage themselves in being fathers. This is while in most of the cases, mothers do not have to make this decision. It's more a continuity of course, symbiosis. You can explain in many ways, both physiological and cultural. But anyhow, underline a big difference. And then I was speaking of polarities. Now, another thing which I want to bring and tends to run throughout the whole of my attempt to explain the father going through his history is that in present-day masculine identity, in the present-day identity of man, there is a bipolarity, which has still a lot of tension and does not really have a good synthesis. Namely, the bipolarity between the father, the paternal, whatever, and the pre-paternal, pre-father, that is, I would call it more simply, the competitive male, the animal male. Okay? There is still a struggling, a lack of synthesis between these two polarities, while, again, on women's side, there is not that. And if we anticipate what I want to be, of course, the conclusions of my talk, namely coming to nowadays, where we see how much the juvenile delinquency of the delinquency of young males tends to increase, typically in situations in which fathers are absent, you know, we see that the absence of the father, the disappearance of one of the polarities, reawakens the more animal, competitive, you know, bullying kind of identity. You don't see that on the feminine side. Of course, we have nowadays a lot of delinquency also among young girls, but as we know, it tends to happen when they have a boyfriend who is a delinquent boy. As with strong addictions, you have teenagers, addicted girls, when they have, it starts on the masculine side, all this misadaptation, and is much more evident, much more statistically prevalent on the masculine side, less evident on the feminine, not only, but when it manifests itself on the feminine side, it is usually because of a very direct influence of the masculine. This is the starting point of my talk, and as I said, there are still, in spite of the wave of books on the father, of the last years, the last decades, particularly in the US, it seems that in the world the ratio between books on the mother and books on the father is still 9-1. So there is still a lot of room to speak about the father. So it's like the attendance at the talks, you know. Fathers are absent in everything. These are the starting points. Now, I want to run through the history of the father to sketch with you a psycho-history as an image, because, yes, I was anticipating images of the father. Tomorrow I will bring also some slides, but something which probably, yes, was anticipated also here in the abstract of the father. I would like to give you, for the father, an image of verticality, okay? And I have taken that, I think it's correct to pay tribute, as you say, to an American author from whom I have taken this image, Robert Bly, who he speaks of the horizontal and vertical dimension, or horizontal and vertical way of looking, gaze, and of the fact that we fall more and more, as far as masculine identity is concerned, into this horizontal dimension, that is, in a society of the brothers, without much link to the previous generations, right? Which is a very well-known fact, after all, of which we always speak, namely, we always notice and say with a certain preoccupation that Nowadays, teenagers, unlike those of the previous generation, tend to have as models their peers. No? It's a society of peers, or maybe of a sort of an animal pack, regression to the animal male again. You know, you have maybe a little bit of the alpha male, but this, so this horizontal dimension, the horizontal influence of the peers. So keep in mind horizontal, vertical. And now let's start with the historical origin of the father. As I said, that it is not given. It's practically history. It's a gift of history. Or better to be more specific, it starts already in prehistory, but in a relatively recent prehistory, which means that it is evolutionary, not yet enough consolidated, probably perfect, you know. And okay, we don't have time to enter all these things, but what I wanted to underline, what I have worked on in my study and is in the book, is the fact that the father, yes, is a result of a cultural evolution also in the sense that if you take the evolution, the animal evolution, the Darwinian evolution, you don't see decisive elements out of which the modern masculine personality is born. I mean, there are no essential, of course we have lost the hair in comparison to any, but nothing so essential, which also stays for the fact that the main invention is psychological, is cultural, although it takes place probably in the last few hundred thousand of years, so not recently. While on the feminine side, there are physiological modifications which are quite evident. This is not the case on the masculine side. So anyhow, when does it happen? Let's say we all more or less know, even if we are not paleoanthropologists, that our ancestors left the jungle gradually in Africa, Central Southern Africa, and went gradually into the savannas and moved gradually. I'm of course synthesizing things which happened over millions of years and at least specifically focusing in the last hundred thousands of years, and changed their diet from being basically vegetable fruit gatherers into more and more meat hunters and meat eaters. With which, because they were in the savannah, they took the, how do you say, vertical, upright position, vertical sense, upright position, because that was useful in the savannah for hunting you, that freed the hand, their head was already developing, bigger brain, the hand interacted in a virtuous circle with the head, the brain grew, many new possibilities given by the hand, as you know, and hunting became more and more complex, the new diet allowed them to grow bigger. And hunting, here comes the beginning of human society. We know from excavation that it went farther and farther away from the residents, from the cave or whatever they live, into a more complex hunting, okay, which meant a minimum of organization, which meant they were beginning to think and to have mental images, because animals follow, hunt an animal only as long as they smell or see the animal. After a while, if they don't see or perceive it the prey with the senses. After a while, it depends on the kind of animal. It can vary between a few seconds and some minutes, but they will drop. And it is a fact that with this hunting, our ancestors did something more and more complex until they hunted in real groups, maybe for days, going away. And we know also from the excavations that the more they went away, the more they hunted bigger and more complex animals, where they had, of course, to coordinate, use the first weapons, and was getting more dangerous, the more it became a specialized activity of only men. We know it from the excavation, because next to the bones of big animals, farther away, there are only masculine bones, okay? And we know that this is the beginning of somehow sort of human society, because anthropology tells us that the universal characteristic of all human society is a certain separation in roles between men and human, while the pre-hunters, pre-humans, did not have this separation, okay? And this was due, we know it, to very simple modification simple and complex, but which we know even if we are not specialists, namely that because of the upright position and the lack of hair, and the fact that the human infant is a premature, more and more premature, depending on the mother for very long, and was becoming more and more premature because of the head was getting bigger and the upright position was making the basin of women not bigger, and so on. Babies were more and more dependent. So women had to stay while men were hunting. And what happens here? That you have the first selection, the first time that there is really a selection, that I'm speaking very trivially of the natural selection, selection for something which is, in my opinion, a purely psychological, cultural character in those men. Namely, as we have said, that they had more and more, they started, this is, of course, fascinating for me as a Jungian. I have not been there, but the reconstruction tells us that this is a logical reconstruction, because we see the starting point and the point of arrival, no? That we have a lot of mental images. As they have developed mental images in going farther and farther away, because they had, of course, the memory of the animal they were hunting, some of these masculine beings started going back to their partners and to their children, which is something unprecedented. They started, in a way, being fatherly, paternal, and not just this competitive male. Because the competitive male, at all animal level, including the most developed big apes, first of all, they mate with the female through fighting. No, they are not monogamous. There is one big male which forms a sort of harem. They have this hunt. And then as far as eating is concerned, they also have this animal attitude of eating when they are hungry and they have something to eat, and then dropping the food. No particular patterns of conservation, let alone of bringing it to the children, while the mothers have it. Of course, now I am generalizing something which you might have read in some books. It is found that sometimes some father, but I mean, I am speaking of the basic rule among practically the large majority of apes and of males and so on. So, some of those males went back and brought the food. And how do we know it? Of course, again, I have not been there, and we are speaking of prehistorical hundreds of thousands of years ago, nothing recorded. Why do we know it? We know it because we exist. Because those who had not this paternal instinct kept eating it and did not nourish their children. So they didn't have descendants. They didn't form the families. We are the descendants of those which were selected by nature, of course. Those kept having more and more children. The others who did not have those instincts, they either died or have to go back to the jungle and to the prior, to the previous abyss. They couldn't, the new kind of living practically imposed the selection of these paternal characteristics. No? And as I say, it is fascinating for me as a Jungian because it has to do with somehow also with the formation of mental images. Clearly we are speaking of a time where there are not yet concepts, but there must be something which is memory and mental images. And the qualities which get selected, which are, as I insist, psychological, almost protocultural qualities, are also somehow, I would say, the core of what we have called paternal qualities throughout all the 1,000 years of our Western civilization, which, whether we like it or not, has been a patriarchal civilization, no? And only recently started changing. But, I mean, in our patriarchal tradition, of course, to put in extremely simple terms something complex, the father is the one of the two parents entrusted to a sort of secondary education. The mother protects and fulfills the needs of the child in a first primary phase. The father enters only in a secondary phase and, to simplify a complex problem, rather that does not fulfill the needs and the instinct, but on the contrary teaches how to limit the needs, the instinct, and to organize an economy of these drives in the name of future goals, of more complex goals. No, paternal qualities have to do with limit yourself now, limit your drive now, in order to reach a more complex goal in the future. Still, no, the father telling the child, no, you're not studying enough, do it, it's harsh, but in the end, you will be satisfied, you will come back and tell, I mean, the good father, at least, if he still exists. No, is this tradition, okay? Well, but what I wanted to see is that, to me, this reconstruction is fascinating and makes sense, of course, because of the fact that human society, little by little, came into being. Something more or less like this must have happened. But what comes out is that there was an evolution in the masculine towards these qualities, no? A saving of it. And so it's a self-restraint of the male. And this is why I was anticipating, I see, you know, also in the abstract, that this is a quality of the father, this may be fixation with discipline, is something structural, belonging really to the father. As you see from the color of my beard, I belong to that generation of the 60s and the 70s, for instance, where there was a very harsh criticism of the father, you know, and it was very fashionable to say, oh, the father, traditional patriarchal father, is authoritarian, and this is, for instance, a degeneration of Western capitalistic bourgeois society of the a lot of blah blah in this sense. I must say, I didn't go with that much in those times, but nowadays, anyhow, after having worked on this topic, I would not say this, I would say quite the opposite. Namely, it's a structural quality of the father, because he is born, what we call the father, is born with this self-imposition, self-discipline. Therefore, not by chance, his role was then taking care of discipline, you know, teaching discipline in the family. is from the very beginning something like this. So the first families, the first monogamous families, and the first bounding between fathers and children was started. As I was recalling, of course, there are many, many other changes, but for instance, in the women or pre-women or those proto-humans, I don't know how we want to call them, but as I was saying, as the feminine identity of nowadays is more consistent, has more continuity, is more an evolution of the animal life, also in those times there were still evolutions in the feminine beings which were also physiological, not just this like in the masculine. Namely, we all know, I think, this, that in even the most evoluted animal, the most near to us, with many quotation marks, because in reality we know that the big apes are not exactly our ancestor. Our ancestors are the missing links and so on. But approximately, big apes are still studied nowadays, you know, to have an idea of how we have evolved. And in all the, as I was recalling, pre-human beings, even the nearest, there is no monogamous family, there is no father, and the binding, also the sexual binding between the masculine and the feminine, is very different from ours, in that also the females have the heat period, and there is a mating only during that heat period. Okay, and this is why then the female specialize in taking care of the children, and the masculine, as usual, specialize in looking for other women in those times, you know. Because it's very difficult to find, because nature tells you, you know, it wants fecundation, but it's just a short period, so you have to tick, and then they had to fight. And as we know, we know it, we know that these animals are not monogamous very well, even nowadays, because if we go to a zoo, we see, for instance, that the gorilla, the male gorilla, is twice as big as the female. Okay? This means there is no monogamy. It's a very simple zoological law, because this means that the selection among the males, the masculine genetic character, takes place through masculine competition. As I said, it's not monogamous that all male have children. They fight, and only the biggest have children. So there is a continuous selection for masculine. While we humans are usually, on the average, what the men are only 15% bigger than women, which means that we have been monogamous for quite a while now. No, we are not so directly the descendant of those apes. That is, that we haven't been functioning through this masculine competition, okay? So, but I wanted to... So the feminine physiology evolves so that the sexuality becomes then possible practically most of the time, the whole month. And, for instance, this is fascinating for me, who have been brought up as a Catholic with all these things, because the Catholic Church still claims, you know, that sexual life, even in a married couple, is meant because of procreation. And on the contrary, evolutionary research tells us very clearly nowadays that already in those times, that is in the last few hundred thousand years, sexuality has evolved so as to enforce a binding, no, an alliance, which has developed also because farming couples develop psychology, develop images. I mean, be it love or fighting, you know, it's part of this human evolution. But anyhow, it's part of this, and we see it in the fact that we have a continuous erotic binding. So, but to this with this I wanted to complete my point, you know, that somehow we masculine beings are more simple. We have not evolved that much, of course, we don't know, from the animals. Females have evolved more. The point is that we men have evolved somehow with this sort of cultural creation or this selection of psychological qualities, which was a powerful engine for starting human society. And then we know that every kind of human society, there is this missing link, and as I said, the most evolved animals do not have father, but every society, even the most primitive, has a father. So in this black hole, black period, something like the things I have described has happened. And human society have all a father. Let's drop now aside the old question whether the so-called tribal primitive society are patriarchal, matriarchal, matrilineal. For our topic, it is relevant that they have a stable masculine figure, even if sometimes it is the uncle, but it's this, you know. As I said, the essential thing in the paternal quality is not the fact of having been the generating father, is this intention, this adoption, is the intention of taking care of the education and having a stable binding. And now one mythological image, so that to respond to Connie, you know, who was asking me whether I was quoting the Iliad, right? My book in Italian is called The Gesture of Hector, and Hector is the Hector of the Iliad, and the Iliad is, the first epics of the West, the first of the two Homeric poems, and it is a whole warrior. I mean, unlike the Odyssey, which is more complex, we don't have time to enter the Odyssey, and the Odysseus might deal with it tomorrow. But in the Iliad, there is only one paternal figure. The whole poem is a whole fighting, and actually it is interesting to me, for instance, again as a Jungian, I have the fantasy there is really something which we call a collective unconscious, and the collective unconscious of the Greeks was then still very impregnated by the fact that the father was something recent and difficult and had just been created. You know, behind the father there is still the competing male, and the old Iliad somehow is still a metaphor of this effort, how to create out of the competitive male, because they are all warriors fighting for one female, not Helen, the most beautiful. So it's a metaphor of this primitive masculine being. And all warriors, if you remember, as often in epics, it's difficult to get the military aspect, which might have been immense and very interesting. You know, the excavation, it has really existed, but Homer describes mostly duels. So it's really these rituals of the fighting male and with a horse tail, and they try to impress the adversary, shouting their names and so on. So it's a big metaphor of this situation. It is my opinion, I propose you the idea that somehow the masculine identity had renovated itself so much and so radically through the creation, quotation marks, of what we have called the father, and through Greek civilization, which is the first one of the West and the most patriarchal somehow, or at least it starts being very patriarchal, it had also reached somehow, it has been said, the first is also somehow the best, you know, the aesthetical creation or the literary creation are the top ones. So there was something which Jung would call a psychic inflation of this father quality. So this creation, this new identity, was very successful, and there was an inflation, and there was even this mythology all based on the father. As you might remember, Zeus, the father of all the gods, generates from his head, and they are... So the father becomes the sole generator. But anyhow, to go to Hector, why did I take him as a metaphor of the whole study and has been put as a title then in the English publisher said, no, you keep it as Italian because you are intoxicated with this classical mythology, but for us and for the Americans it would be too much to put Hector as a title, you know. So anyhow, Hector comes into his home in the sixth book of the Iliad. It's the only book of all the books which represents a domestic scene. And Hector is often described by Homer, you know, in these ritual adjectives which make also the musical rhythm original of the Homeric poem, as the defensor of the city or the defensor of the children, which is to me very beautiful and very poetic and really points to that father quality and to these feelings which are now denied again with a regression to the one-sided macho qualities, you know, but what I was anticipating, that in reality in Greek literature and poetry you have expressions of delicate feeling connected to the father. But of course he is an exception, and he is a defensor of the children, of his child and of the children of the old city, because then the sociological conception is still a very simple one. Somehow he is the main prince, the son of the king, and the whole city is sort of an extension of the royal family. Anyhow, let's try to recall this episode. He's back home because the Greeks are preparing apparently a terrible attack, and he wonders whether next day he can really be home again and embrace his child and wife. So he goes home, he embraces his wife, yeah, that too is a very beautiful example of Greek poetry, also in the sense of monogamy, because with all our love stories and of course the total shamelessness of the Greeks, I mean that scene, which is by many considered the most beautiful love scene of epics, simply takes place between husband and wife. One day when they think they might not meet again. The point is that after embracing the wife, Andromache, Hector wants to embrace the child. And the child cries and turns his head away, does not want to embrace him. The child is a small child, about 1 year old, I can reconstruct. What happens? Hector and Andromache look at each other for a few seconds puzzled. There is again this beautiful description through Homer, because to me he really describes a psychological situation and something which was unconscious becoming conscious without our boring interpretation. I mean, he is really also not only a literary genius, but a genius of that psychology. There is this description of their silence, and then without speaking, they understand. They understand that he, the father, came home from the battlefield as a warrior, still dressed as a warrior. So the child is not recognizing him. He's scared by the ponytail on the helm, on the glittering of the weapons and things like this. Which, I mean, Can you imagine something more expressive, more beautifully, symbolically expressing this duality of the masculine identity and the difficulty of putting them together, of alternating, of either to have one or the other. It's very difficult to move, and this is expressed beautifully in the fact that he simply had to move quickly from the battlefield to the palace. So then the description of Homer, of course, is that he takes off his helm, leaves down his weapons, and can embrace the child. And by embracing the child, the gesture of Hector, this is why I insisted on that gesture, is really so vertical, this verticality of the father. He prays to Zeus as the god of the sky. It's an anticipation somehow, also has been said, of course, of the monotheism which was to come in the West through an extension from Judaism into Christianity. And Zeus is there, some sort of head of the gods. And of course, there is this traditional dichotomy, while the mother represents the earth, the father spiritual values, the mother is nourishing like the earth. And he says, Zeus, I pray you make this, I don't know if I will come back, but make that one day this child will be stronger than his father. And this is so beautiful and so poetic, and so, I must say, also a bit as a Jungian, I have used it to a lot of truths in Freud's interpretation, I don't want to, but it's one-sided, quite one-sided, and the sad thing is that it's a modern labeling, it's a modern creation, which is being reductive and negative. We have tried to take some distance, attributing it to Greek myth. We don't say it's the Freudian complex, but we call it the Oedipus complex. We say it's in Greek myth. In reality, as I wanted to recall in this more ancient instance, and in many instances, there are actually not only loving fathers and fathers who want the child, the son, to be superior to them. Okay, not only equal to them, not only they are not jealous, but superior to them. And as far as this inflation of the father, this inflation of the Greeks is concerned, I have used, for instance, Jung's idea of enantiodromia, you know, the reversal into the opposite. You know, the enantiodromia, again, it's a concept which Jung takes from Greek philosophy, no? The reversal into the opposite. So the situation was unbalanced. In the attempt to find something new, boom, there has been a reversal. And namely, the father identity was so weak and non-existing, had to be invented, and at a certain point, through the success of this invention, there was an inflation. From the feeling of being potentially excluded, because in the animal realm, as I said, most of the males are excluded, only some become father, and then how they lead a less complex, more really animal life than the mothers with their children. Fathers got inflated in Greece by their production and invented the idea which penetrated into our West through Aristoteles, through science and philosophy till very recent times, 17th and even 18th century. This is described, for instance, also in Hillman's The Myth of Analysis, a big part of it. So anyhow, I don't know if you are familiar, practically speaking, or the idea of the homunculus somehow in the sperma of the man. The little child is contained. That means that the father gives the baby to the mother, and the mother is a very dear nourisher, but she's not genetically a parent. She's just a nurse. So we, you see, it's, there is an hyper-compensation, no? An antiodromia in this sense. I have called it agricultural analogy. For me, I mean, trying to reconstruct it from other Greek texts which point to the fact that they were conceiving this mistake. It might have gone like this. The Greeks were also the first lay, a secular observer, founder of natural science, very precocious, very exact. They were, for instance, watching as their gods were totally irrational. They were good for myths, but not teaching humans anything of worth. You know, they were lunatics, totally. So, they developed philosophy, no? While then Christianity or Judaism developed philosophical thinking within religion. As you know, from Socrates on, it's practically, let's pay obedience to the God, but for God's sake, just formally, you know, lip service. I mean, secular thinking, philosophy, and natural sciences. So, but anyhow, among natural sciences, the observation of agriculture, for instance, the plant, no? And what happens if you look at one tree? There is the existing tree, and then a new tree will be born out of the fact that some seeds fall from the existing tree into the ground, and the seeds are the origin of this new tree. Okay, this is we all know this. Then, though, a false equation started. The existing tree gives the seed that is the father who gives the seed, the sperma. The mother is the earth, usual equation, right, who receives it. Okay, she nourishes it, but then the child, the new tree, is he or she a child of the earth or of the existing tree? No, of the tree, of the previous tree. So only the father is a real parent. This is, so you see a total inflation and a total, but very interesting. I mean, in Greek and Roman antiquity, in my opinion, the father reaches his highest point. Somehow in Roman society, it is even more so, in that the father in Greece, let's say, had a full right on his children, a right of life and death. That is, he could theoretically at least punish the children, even killing them. It was just his right, as long as they were his children living in his home. They didn't marry and form a new family. The Roman father had this right upon his children as long as he, the father, was alive. That is, he was an old grandfather and his children were already married, having their own children, he could still punish them and theoretically even kill them. It was a total... Though to remind you how radically in this very complex, of course, the Roman law is already quite complex and precocious in its functioning as creation, precociously developed. The father in Rome had to perform a public ceremony lifting in public his son in front of an audience and declaring loudly, "This is my son, I will nourish him." But actually, I didn't say that. Nourishing, the expression pa-fa, which we find in all Indo-European languages, has to do with the nourishing function, which is, of course, different from the one of the mother, but it's very important. So, taking responsibility for that. So anyhow, This was institutionalized through this ceremony. So even if the child, even if he was born within a legitimate family, without this symbolic adoption, which is again a vertical gesture like this, you know, lifting the child to the sky, the child was not a legitimate child recognized. He didn't have the right to inherit from the father. Yes, again, I have to apologize with Rimelody. It's, yes, because of the bias of these times, of the limited rights, and also, I must say, in my study, I make ideally reference mostly to father and son, then in the discussion, there is often, of course, discussion, what about the daughter? But because, of course, the son has to be the next father, so I'm speaking of this psychological paternal quality being symbolically entrusted to the son. Okay, so I go on another 10 minutes and then we make a pause, okay? And I now make, say, a big jump into modernity because of the time. And in order to prepare the ground for a discussion on our present times, what happens. Well, to just fly over these chapters which I have developed, you know, I've been working some 8-10 years on this topic. Of course, I, for instance, wonder whether Christianity wasn't already a first step towards decadence of the father, a first announcement, at least from a theological point of view, of course, not in society, because for the first time, the truth, the official truth, the verbal of a monotheistic religion, of a universal religion, and so on, was expressed by a son and not by the father. There is something of a radical anticipation of our modern times in this, you know, in Christianity. But anyhow, this at a very theological level. And then with the Middle Ages, society is somehow withdrawn and quiet, and it seems that as far as the father is concerned, not much happens, although the church tends to gradually take away a certain authority from fathers because it builds a structure which substitutes the father, and not by chance father, institutional fathers, which are still called fathers and form a moral authority. So there is often a split. There are so many still jokes in Italy about the pious women who, instead of in the need of an advice, instead of turning to the husband who is a non-existing human, they go to the the priest, you know, to the father in this sense. It's a still very typical situation somehow. But anyhow, where really things have a big turn is with the big revolutions. Namely, I am referring to the French and American Revolution, where let's again have in mind the vertical image. No? The family is very vertical with the father at the top, and society is very vertical with the king at the top. And in the Enlightenment period, which prepares the big revolution, there are criticisms. Of course, there have always been revolution and always been criticism of the existing regimes, but for the first time, criticism becomes really systematic, goes on uninterrupted for one full century, becomes a philosophical trend, etc., and connects a criticism of the injustice in society and of the injustice in the family. There are, so not only in political terms, but also as far as our topic is concerned, revolutions are essential. In the French Revolution, always content, there is even the symbolism that you cut the head to the king, I mean, this idea of verticality. And, as far as the problem of vertical, that is the lineage, the genealogic tree, yeah, father, son, father, son, father, son, and horizontal as the modern alternative to it, is concerned. For instance, I was saying I have taken things from Bligh and I admire him and so on, but I have criticized his idea in this because he speaks of the second half of the 20th century as the time when all these things happened, and in the 50s of the 20th century, says the father was still in place and everything was okay, there was no horizontal dimension. Now, if we pay attention to the French Revolution, the motto of the French Revolution, so the idea, the new political idea is liberté, égalité, fraternité, no? Brotherhood, right? So, for the first time and radically, the horizontal link, the brotherhood, is recognized by the new ideas, is more important. You know, the new society is a link, which is the idea of basically of democracy, you know, of being equals and respecting each other as equals. So the brotherhood is more important than respecting the vertical principle of authority, the symbolic father in politics. So there is an enormous change here, and we might be more or less familiar with all the other sides of consequences. For instance, the father was responsible for the education of the children. The big revolutions change everything in the sense that gradually the state becomes, not the mother, for God's sake, but the state becomes responsible. So the prerogative for the education of children. Yes?
But wasn't that also true in Athens when they rejected the early monarchy and pursued fraternity?
It's very complex, the Athenian society. There is a certain, there are classes, there are social, it's complex. There is a brotherhood, but there are also social classes, so you cannot speak of the, partly, yes. Mm-hmm. And there is, of course, somebody at the top, but there is a democratic, very quick rotation of these figures, yes. And, five more minutes. What is the other revolution worth mentioning? It's the Industrial Revolution, that is the whole of the 19th century. Actually, this has been described by the German Freudian psychoanalyst Alexander Michalich, who was also a cult in the 60s and 70s in Europe, but he was relatively well known here too, in his famous book Towards a Fatherless Society. His analysis runs so that with the Industrial Revolution, basically, fathers were en masse taken away from the children. The transmission of profession, that is, of male identity, was going from father to son in the most literal sense. Changes of profession were the exception. The rule was that one son would just watch the father and learn the more than 90% of the population was made of peasants. Of course, you would see your father, admire his strength because he was cutting trees, plowing the field, and so on, you know. But then also in the cities, the few bourgeois profession or the smiths or whatever were just like this. You would learn watching your father. With industrialization, everything changes. You just know that your father disappears, and we know that there is, for the first time, a mass intoxication of these male figures. That is, an enormous amount of those male workers, just they work as animals and then become alcoholists. There is a lot of prostitution and so on because they are away from their families. No, this terrible situation. What is very interesting and very tragic for us. Just keep in mind, it's an anticipation of a very tragic situation of modern times, in that then we have for the first time and very precociously the father who is linked to his children just by money coming. He's no example, no relationship, you know, just hardly comes home and so on. So this is the Industrial Revolution. And then we have our dear modern times, that is the century which we have left behind our shoulders, which we can divide very roughly into two parts. The first part is dominated by wars and dictatorships, at least in Europe. And but I mean, the Americans have participated in the two world wars, and you have had, even every time I speak about this, I am made aware of the fact, no, we have had three generations of missing father, two world wars and the Vietnam, right? Mm-hmm. So of course, again, for God's sake, wars have always existed, but for the first time you have such a mass mobilization, you know, all fathers go away, such a distance in time, wars affect the whole of society. You have just time to recover, because the family wars existed, but then the family, once the disaster of the war were repaired, the family would simply slowly go back into the previous situation. In the world wars, you have a rotation. It gets worse and worse because the next generation have to go away. And this is a primacy we had in Italy. We were precocious in the bad things of modernity. We usually are in the West, but with some delay, we are lazy, which is not bad because of many things of modernity. But we had a very typical phenomenon of modernity, namely the veterans of the First World War were the first veterans. They were not heroes. They didn't get back into society. Those who had families and were married, they were not accepted, they were rejected because they had been too long away. And anyhow, they had learned, they had become a killing machines, you know, maladjusted, which is the typical thing which has been studied and analyzed for the Vietnam, but was very typical of Italy for First World War, and actually a phenomenon of which you all unfortunately know has a stark connection with this, namely fascism is born out of it. Mussolini is an ex-socialist who drops the socialists because they are against the war. He pushes for the war, he manages to have Italy entering war, and then at the end he uses the veterans, it makes them into a militia to have them beating the workers who are on strike because there are terrible social problems, unemployment and so on. So he ends the strikes with violence using the veterans, who just are these maladjusted people who can only fight. So he faces both problems and gets some approval, say, from the bourgeois scared family, you know. So somehow fascism and dictatorship have some appearance of a return of the father, okay? Modernity is accelerating. Of course, the technological, economic transformation are also enormous. Then the instability is brought about by war, and then there is a big nostalgia, conscious nostalgia for more law and order in society, but also for a return of paternal authority in the family. So this is exploited by the dictators, okay? But again, I won't enter in detail, but if somebody, for instance, wants to read in my book, I have a dedicated analysis to this. The fascism and Nazism are only at the first and very weak appearance a return of the father. In reality, it's an acceleration of this going towards the competitive male and not the paternal. Okay, it's really the triumph of this aggressive male characteristic, and even both Mussolini and Hitler themselves personally had this character of alpha male, the aggressive male of the pack, and not paternal, in every sense, both with the children and with the friends in society. And these paramilitary groups which surround them are really the pack, you know, and the other. So everything goes in that direction, and in the end, those dictatorship, I'm not referring just to the right-wing dictatorship, basically communism becomes the same under Stalin and so on, it's exactly the same degeneration. Apparently, there is a desire to have a strong masculine, the father of the country. In reality, as they become a disaster, as they bring about so much destruction and death, as they are fathers who bring death and not life, in my opinion, on the contrary, they very strongly contribute to accelerate the demise of the father. What I intend is that the father disappears as a symbol, you know, so the modern criticism to patriarchy starts there with an enormous historical responsibility, of course, but then we are here to discuss those things because, of course, I think we all share some worry that those criticisms to the excesses of patriarchy were necessary, but we might have thrown away some baby with the water, okay? This is the idea. So anyhow, dictatorship are unfortunately an acceleration because they qualify in a negative sense the symbol, the collective symbol of the father. There is nothing corresponding. There is no symbol of the great mother, of the mother of the country, great governor, great goddess, which, you know, gets stained in any way. Nothing. There is a stability of the symbol of the mother. If you read, for instance, Neumann's writing, Quaternion also about the feminine and the paternal, speaks of that, you know, the stability also the symbol of the mother. So anyhow, you have this destabilization in politics. In the First World War, again, maybe something you might not be aware of, you have a very symbolic situation in the Italian army, in the relationship between soldiers and officers, the officers, of course, representing somehow the militarized expression, the militarized metaphor of the father. We have on about 5 million enlisted soldiers at the end of the war. We counted more than 900,000, court-martial cases for disobedience to the officers. They even were exchanging, you know, gifts and making friends with the Austrians, our enemies, you know, and encouraging each other to shoot the officers, you know. Think what a symbolic... Then, you know, in Italy, Fascism comes right after that, so it doesn't really enter official history. It's not so much in the history books because it's unpopular, but this was reality. People were fed up, and this is a criticism of every patriarchal authority in every aspect of society, from, you know, school and university teachers to politicians to officers. And in the second half of the 20th century, and then I really stop, but this is something which is our reality with which we are all acquainted. There is the statistical disappearance of fathers. I mean, the amount of divorces explodes, get out of hand. In big cities like New York or Paris, at the turn of the century, from passing from the 20th to the 21st century, it has been counted that maybe already more than 50% of the children will grow up without their father, you know, due to divorces and things like this. And these are the places, and of course the social classes and the places which tend to set the trend, okay, for other things. You certainly are familiar with the fact that in the U.S. this was a tragical reality rather of the African-American typically of the ghetto, you know, being fatherless. It has penetrated the white sector of the population and the middle classes and everywhere. So this, which was once, I still refer, of course I don't have to tell you that, I still refer also in my book, and I still read it, for me, an almost unsurpassed classic of anthropological studies is Margaret Mead. You know? And so there are several writings of her about this and the whole question of the blacks and so on. Now, the point is that the problem has not been solved for the black sector of the population, but that the whites have the same problem now. You know? And in Latin America, actually, to me, again, I will not enter this, but one of the reasons of the backwardness, structural backwardness of Latin America as opposed to Anglo-Saxon America has to do with this. Because from the very beginning, the structure of the Latin American family is compromised and is lacking a father. There is a big, big sector of fatherless children in all Latin American countries, not just as a result of divorces recently, but throughout all history. Because the founding fathers in the States, you remember, were couples. No? And the couple split only recently, the divorce is accepted. Mm-hmm. But the Spaniards were conquerors. They came without the women. And only a few of them would go back and take maybe aristocratic princess of Spain to get, but the great majority, 99%, would simply kill the Indios and marry some Indian woman, or not even marry, just make a lot of illegitimate children. Anyhow, there was no fun. So I mean, the lack of father is very well. I mean, if you go to Mexico, for instance, there is an expression they say padre, no father. To mean something fantastic. It's not in Spanish, not in Spain. It's typical Mexican, and I've asked colleagues, intelligent people there, because I didn't find that in etymological dictionary. They say, why? What does that mean? And they think a moment and they say, well, because this is the most valuable thing we have been always longing for and have missed in our history, you know. So the important thing is padre to the, oh, this is a successful thing, or como es padre, que está. So anyhow, we know that fathers have disappeared statistically. These, roughly, I think there is a statistic which says throughout the 20th century in the U.S., divorces have increased by 700%. Mm-hmm. In Germany, in the last 40 years, they have increased by 400-450%. And things like this, I mean, it's all over the state. So the father is missing, and is missing also in my field of study, because psychoanalysis somehow has started, as you know, with Freud fixation for the father, and then at least the Freudians have become neo-Freudians, Anna-Freudians, Kleinians, and they have studied more and more the first infancy. But the first infancy, this brings us back to what I've called as the primary phase. And the primary phase is the interaction of okay, but what about the father? What about society? And also, I am one so with some interest for, I use psychoanalysis also to try to understand not only, you know, as a clinical instrument for this person, but also to understand. And so, what about society? With this studying, with this tendency of psychoanalytic study, of course, they fill the gap. It was important to analyze first infancy, but if we remain always stuck with that, the whole society disappears, because, of course, what we study is an interaction which is preverbal between an infant which doesn't speak and the mother. So society disappears, and the father, of course, is taken as granted as somebody who is not there. Thank you for your patience, and I hope we can discuss a bit now.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.